One of the big questions, of course, is how did life get started here on Earth and maybe across the universe? And there are a lot of really interesting chemicals that are part of this process of abiogenesis, of life itself. And one of the most important is phosphorus. And phosphorus is this really interesting chemical. It's really critical in DNA. It provides sort of one of the core backbones of the way life works. And we really couldn't have life without phosphorus. And phosphorus is a very tricky element because it mostly sunk down into the middle of the earth, bound up with metals, and it's gone. The phosphorus that is left over, that is available to life on Earth, in many cases has been bound up in ways that aren't quite as bioavailable. It's a tricky chemical if you want to be able to make it soluble in water, and a lot of astrobiologists consider phosphorus to be one of the rate-limiting steps for life to get going on a planet. And I'm kind of obsessed with the search for life in the universe. So my guest today is Harry Brodsky. He's a PhD candidate in geological science at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he's a member of the Templeton Geomicrobiology Lab. And I brought on Harry to talk about just what role phosphorus played in the formation of life on Earth, how we could be searching for phosphorus across the solar system and across the universe. So enjoy this fascinating conversation with Harry Brodsky. Harry, an idea that sort of came to my brain from an interview that I did with somebody previously was that Earth itself, with all the various chemicals in the biospheres and all of these sort of cycles that go on, it's actually very inefficient. And because there are limitations of various chemicals, and that makes our planet kind of out of whack and not very efficient, you know, and phosphorus is sort of identified as one of these main chemicals that is just limited. How badly does planet Earth need phosphorus?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what's interesting is phosphorus is extremely abundant in life. It makes up a large part of many core biomolecules. It's a really important part of DNA. In fact, it makes up the backbone. And so life needs a lot of phosphorus to get going. And as you mentioned, the Earth doesn't have very much. In fact, most of Earth's phosphorus is in the core, 99% or something like that, because phosphorus is actually more soluble in metals than it is in rocks. So when the Earth was forming and it was basically this just big hodgepodge of elements, and it's starting to differentiate, you know, the iron is sort of sinking, the silica is rising to become the mantle and the crust, the phosphorus actually mostly partitions into the core. And so life on Earth will never get to see that phosphorus. But a small percentage of the phosphorus on Earth is in the crust, and all of life today subsides on that reservoir. So phosphorus is being transferred between the crust and the oceans and the mantle through all of these Earth cycles. And you reach a sort of steady state of phosphorus in each of these reservoirs. And so astrobiologists look at this and they say, you know what, there's really not a lot of phosphorus here. How could life have sort of integrated it into the biochemistry, you know, or it's pre-life. How could pre-life have integrated phosphorus into its chemistry if phosphorus was so dilute? Organic chemists have tried to react phosphate and organic molecules in water, but it's really, really difficult chemistry. Those molecules just want to break apart as soon as they come together. And so it's been a real mystery how you get that phosphorus into life. It's definitely one of the most challenging elements to get into the prebiotic system. It's kind of the holdout.
Right. But like, imagine if we had 10 times the phosphorus, 100 times the phosphorus, 1,000 times, like how much phosphorus, like when I think about all of the chemistry that I did in university and in high school, you know, we were often thinking about the rate limiting step, that there was going to be some chemical that there wasn't enough of it, and then that was going to sort of halt the chemical process. But if you just fed Earth as much phosphorus as it wants, how much does it want?
That's a good question. And it really matters what kind of phosphorus we're talking about. So most people are thinking of phosphorus as this ion called phosphate. It has four oxygens attached to the central phosphorus molecule. It's used in fertilizer. It's all over the place. So that's the form of phosphorus most people think. The problem with phosphate is that it's really insoluble. When it meets other metal ions in water, like calcium or iron, that phosphate will react with the calcium and combine and precipitate as a mineral called apatite. So just to repeat that.
Apatite.
Yeah, it's called apatite. It's what your teeth are made out of, actually. And so if you put more phosphorus into the ocean, because of the chemistry of the ocean, you're not actually going to get more phosphorus into the water, because most seawater is saturated with this mineral called apatite. What that means is that there is some amount of equilibrium between the mineral apatite on the seafloor and the water above it. And so if you were to add phosphate to the ocean, it would immediately precipitate as apatite and get removed from the solution. And so that would be inaccessible for life. But that's phosphate. There are other forms of phosphorus, and I'm really excited to talk today about those other forms of phosphorus that we know about, and they're reduced forms of phosphorus. So what does that mean, reduced? So elements can exist in lots of different charge states, oxidation states, and so phosphorus is normally found in the plus five oxidation states. So in phosphate, those oxygens are sort of hogging those electrons from the phosphorus. Five of those electrons. So it's P5 plus. When you reduce something, it means to add electrons to it. So what you do to phosphate is you just add two electrons and remove an oxygen, and it becomes a new ion called phosphite with an I. And that's phosphorus in the plus three oxidation state. And this form of phosphorus, phosphite, turns out to be much more soluble in water. And so if you were to add phosphorus to the ocean, and you could somehow add it as phosphite and not phosphate, that would really help prebiotic chemistry. That would be a really cool thing to show, that the oceans are sort of filling up with this reduced form of phosphorus, because that would allow the total dissolved phosphorus to be higher. You see how this reservoir of dissolved phosphorus is actually made up of a couple different chemicals. Some of them are soluble and some of them are insoluble. And so we want to figure out what are the soluble ones and how do we produce that on the earth?
Right, right. Now, you know, you have recently, I'm not sure if you did this, but you've gone searching for deposits of phosphate around the world. You know, where do we find large deposits of it here on earth?
Yeah, so phosphate is pretty concentrated in marine sediments because life, as I said, needs a lot of phosphorus. And so ocean life that's sort of doing photosynthesis, there's this cycle. The plankton in the upper ocean are doing photosynthesis. They're dying. Their bodies are sinking to the bottom of the ocean. And that phosphorus is brought with them. So it turns into apatite on the seafloor. So there are rocks out there that are almost pure phosphorus because they're just made up of, they're called phosphorites. And these phosphorites are made up of ancient organisms that have since decayed and given up their phosphorus to the rocks. Now, I've gone around looking for the reduced form of phosphorus called phosphite because we really don't know much about it in terms of its environmental relevance. In fact, people didn't really think it was out there in the environment in abundance until just about 20 years ago when liquid chromatography technology really got going and we figured out how to detect tiny, tiny traces of compounds in fluids. So one of the earliest studies was of sewage. So they took sewage and they found these reduced phosphorus compounds in it. And that was really surprising because environmental chemists didn't really think that you could produce that reduced phosphorus. We should talk a little bit about redox state. So the environment has some amount of, oxygen is a really good one. So we can talk about oxygen. If oxygen is present, there's a tendency for that oxygen to steal electrons. So if you take phosphite and oxygen, that oxygen is going to steal back those electrons from phosphite and turn it back into phosphate. So we're really talking about the stability of these two different compounds. And in some environments on Earth, it's the oxidized version that's most plentiful. And where do you think that is? Well, on the surface, where we have lots of oxygen. So here on the surface, it's phosphate. In the core, it's actually phosphorus metal. And the stability of that form of phosphorus depends on how much oxygen and other electron-stealing compounds are around. So in today's ocean, phosphate is the most abundant. But there's a tiny amount of phosphite that we didn't know about till recently. So I've gone around looking for places where you might find more of this reduced compound. I'm really interested, how can you make it using geology? And where does it get concentrated? Because it's in those places that you might be able to react that reduced phosphorus with a carbon compound and make organic phosphorus. And that is the first step towards phosphorus prebiotic chemistry. It might be surprising to hear, but we have really, really struggled to come up with a plausible scenario where we can form a POC bond, phosphorus, oxygen, carbon, which is so, so common in biochemistry. But we really haven't found a good way to do that.
This bond that life is able to do, there doesn't seem to be an inorganic way of bringing those molecules, those atoms together into a molecule.
Right. That is a big goal right now of prebiotic chemistry, is to understand how you can get to organic phosphorus with just rocks and water. And so there have been a couple ideas proposed. In the past, this problem, there's actually a term, the phosphorus problem. Mm-hmm. And the phosphorus problem goes back to the 50s when this guy first realized that phosphorus is so plentiful in biochemistry. Biochemistry was blown up at that time. People were figuring stuff out about DNA and ATP. And a prebiotic chemist said, but wait, how could that possibly happen without life? These are extremely high energy bonds. You might remember from biology, the energy carrier molecule, ATP. So that's adenosine triphosphate. And it's those phosphate groups on the end that kind of act like springs. And when you release them, it releases so much energy. If you think about that, the reverse reaction must be really hard to do. If it releases a lot of energy to break apart, that means you need that much energy to put them back together.
Right, right. This actually was one of the questions that I was going to be asking you, right? That you've got this really critical role of phosphorus in DNA and in ATP, and yet it's such a difficult molecule to bring together. And so by examining these places where you see these concentrations, does that give you any clues to sort of, you know, what role it might have played in prebiotic life and maybe even abiogenesis?
Yes, definitely. And I'll tell you a little bit about the places I've thought about where this might be happening. So as I mentioned, in order to produce this reduced phosphorus, and that's really the goal, remember, even though it's phosphate in biosystems, the first step, I think, could be to use reduced phosphorus to get the P sort of attached to the organic molecule. And later it can be converted into phosphate. But getting that POC bond is really important. So let me tell you a little bit about the places I've gone to find this reduced phosphorus. It's places with very low oxygen. So you don't want to go to the surface. You don't want to go to like the beach, a lake. You know, that has too much oxygen and you're not going to find this reduced compound. But deep in the Earth's crust, where the mantle meets the crust, water can get all the way down there and there's no oxygen. And the minerals down there are mostly iron and magnesium silicates that suck up that water, and the iron actually rusts. So the iron reacts with the water and produces hydrogen. This is going on in the mantle. Actually, let me back up a second. I really want to show you this rock.
That's the greatest part about interviewing geologists is they come with rocks.
Yeah, this is a fantastic rock. This rock is from the mantle, Fraser.
Wow.
So I got this in Oregon, and you're basically looking at what the mantle looks like. You can see this really rusty exterior here. This is the inside of the rock. Hopefully you can see it's a little bit green. And so what happened in Oregon / California, if you're from California, you might know about the Coast Range ophiolite or the Josephine ophiolite. And what happened was, as California was being made, pieces of the mantle kind of got like shoved up onto land. And so now if you go to southern Oregon, you can see the mantle just sitting there.
Yeah.
And so what I do is I take that rock and I crush it into powder and I react it with phosphate to see whether that mineral can actually provide the electrons to the phosphate. So it's this idea that it's the mantle minerals themselves that could reduce the phosphate to phosphite. So we're not talking about, you know, a Yellowstone hot spring. We're not talking about a lake that dries up and refills. We're really talking about seafloor hydrothermal systems. So water is percolating down through the seafloor crust, and it meets the hot mantle, reacts with the mantle, fills up with hydrogen, possibly reacts with phosphate, and then rises back up to the seafloor. And we know that some of Earth's most primordial metabolisms, some of the earliest ancient, most ancient life on Earth, uses that hydrogen to build organic molecules. So the metabolism is they take hydrogen and carbon dioxide and they form organic molecules. And that metabolism, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that like that seems, you know, if you're getting this process happening across all of the oceans of all of the Earth and you're getting this where it's kind of seeping down to meet the mantle, going through this chemical process, rising back up, that I think, you know, we think about life forming in some small, obscure pond of water or at a hydrothermal vent or what have you. But it sounds like this says, actually, there is no great place to look. It's kind of everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we kind of think of, we have this affectionate term for the upper shallow mantle that's reacting with all the water, producing all the hydrogen, methane, acetate, formate. Those are organic acids that life needs. We call it the kitchen.
Right.
We call it the kitchen because it sort of makes everything we need. But we don't really think of this rock as where life started. So we still do have to think about, where is this fluid going? What fluids is it mixing with? Where? What interface is this happening at? So we do think of, I personally do think of hydrothermal vents as pretty interesting sites because they are the interface between this extremely reducing hydrogen-rich and alkaline fluid that's coming up from the mantle. And it meets seawater, which is carbon dioxide-rich, slightly acidic. That's a huge chemical disequilibrium. And you get this. So this is a hydrothermal vent from the Mid-Cayman Rise. And it's mostly made out of sulfides, a little barite, a little quartz. And it's in places like these that the fluid is coming up from the mantle and meeting the ocean water. And so maybe in an environment like that, you can source those important chemicals from the kitchen, maybe phosphite included, the reduced phosphorus compound. Maybe the kitchen produces that phosphite and brings it up into the ocean where it can then react with organic molecules.
Right. Actually, I've got a question from one of the patrons sort of related to this. Sally Forth asks, did life start at the surface and adapt to the black smokers or vice versa?
That is a great question, and it's definitely up for debate. That's a great question. I personally think life started on the seafloor, but there's lots of reasons to debate that. The most popular theories are sort of wet-dry cycles on land. So you have a lake that's drying out, concentrating all of those interesting molecules, maybe reacting, and then it fills up again, and maybe that cycling can form some kind of prebiotic system. The question asks about black smokers, and black smokers are a kind of hydrothermal vent that is really high temperature, full of iron and sulfur, and it's actually a little bit acidic. And so life there has to deal with a lot of challenges, but there's also a lot of energy to exploit. Back in the 80s, when was the first black smoker discovered? I think it was the 70s, 73 or 4. Yeah, I'm not sure. We can go look that up. But when these black smokers were discovered, biologists were really interested because it's a chemosynthesis. It's life that's divorced from the sun. Today, we think of a different kind of hydrothermal vents as being more relevant to life, and that's alkaline hydrothermal vents. These are not black smokers. The fluid that comes out is clear, and it's not 400 degrees Celsius, but just 80 degrees Celsius. So much, much more mild and hospitable for life. And it's there that you have hydrogen and reducing compounds meeting the ocean water and producing possibly the first metabolisms. So I personally believe that life probably started on the ocean floor and expanded outward, eventually coming onto dry land.
Actually, so I've got another question here. This question comes from Kelly Baker. Is there enough phosphorus on Mars? Will we need to bring it with us?
That's a great question. I think if our technology is good enough, there are lots of good phosphorus deposits that we've found on Mars, including some units in Gale Crater that have been found to contain large amounts of this phosphate salt. So if we ever had a colony on Mars and we needed phosphorus as a nutrient, it might turn out to be better to mine it from a place like Gale Crater than to bring it from home.
Right. So I'd like to shift gears and talk about now this idea of phosphorus and us searching exoplanets. And one classification of these exoplanets are these ocean worlds. And we're, you know, still not entirely sure if we've seen them. There's the Haitian worlds. But you know, when you've got this planet covered in water, how could potentially life be able to get access to these key nutrients?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have a couple ocean worlds in our own solar system that are really, really cool and that NASA has studied in detail. So we have both Enceladus, which orbits Saturn, and Europa, which orbits Jupiter. And they're both really interesting cases of sort of mini planets with cores and oceans, and they're covered in an ice cap. So that's a really interesting system, and prebiotic chemists and biologists have thought about what kind of life could exist there. Maybe life sort of clings to the underside of the ice on top, or maybe life flourishes at the sea floor. We tend to think of interfaces as really useful for life. And that's because life depends on disequilibrium to survive. All life depends on doing chemical reactions that would happen naturally, but they happen so slowly at, you know, room temperature that our enzymes can catalyze those reactions and get energy from it. So we tend to think of the ice-water interface as a pretty cool environment for life, or the seafloor-ocean interface. And as a geologist, I'm thinking about the seafloor. One fantastic discovery happened in the 2010s when the Cassini mission went past Saturn, did a flyby of Enceladus, and witnessed huge plumes coming out of the southern fissures of the planet. So enormous, thousands of miles, these fissures are expelling some sort of material. And so the Cassini craft turned around and looked at this plume and used light to determine that it was mostly water. And so then the scientists were like, okay, well, if water is coming out of the planet, we've got to get a sample. And they sort of hacked their mass spectrometer to be more sensitive to certain compounds that they thought might be in that fluid. And then they flew through it and they got a taste. And what they found was hydrogen and methane and carbon dioxide. And that is pretty cool. When you hear carbon dioxide and methane, those are two very different forms of carbon, and they're not in equilibrium with each other. One is full of oxygen, very oxidized. One is full of hydrogen, very reduced. So to witness that redox disequilibrium is really exciting, because that means that life could use that disequilibrium to extract energy. Now, you asked about nutrients too. And that is a huge question. Does the rock at the bottom of the ocean on Enceladus contain the right elements, the right nutrients for life? And how does that material get into the water? Life needs water, so we need to dissolve those nutrients. They can't just be in rocks. There was recently a paper by Frank Postberg that shows that phosphate does exist in the ocean of Enceladus. Using really high-quality spectroscopic and statistical analyses, they were able to pull out traces from the data of the mass spec, and they could see that sodium phosphate was present in some amount in that sort of material, not quite water, sort of a mystified material that went into that mass spec. And so that article really showed, hey, it's not just a guess anymore. We've got fluid on Enceladus that has energy to be taken up, that has phosphorus to be taken up. So the case just keeps looking better and better.
Yeah. It's really incredible. Like, as you said, you mentioned the dissolved hydrogen, the fuel for potentially life. You've got all of the raw materials, the building blocks, and evidence that you've got these potential chemical reactions. And that's why, in this last decadal survey, NASA set an orbilander for Enceladus as one of its top priorities. And so if you were being part of the team that was designing the instruments for a potential orbilander, what kind of observation would you want to make? What kind of experiment would you want to be able to do? Money is no object. So, what would you like to find out?
Yeah. So I'm really excited for those missions, as you said. I think we're going to learn some fantastic things in the next few decades as NASA visits those planets. I am really, really interested in the composition of the ocean. I want to know the nutrients. Is there sulfur? Is there nitrogen? And I want to know the pH. Is it too acidic? Is it too basic for life? And I want to know if there's energy. What's the redox state? Is there lots of oxygen? Is there no oxygen? And it's a little bit difficult to get at that from the surface. If you land on Enceladus, the ice shell is about 10 kilometers thick, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. And if you landed on it, my first instinct would be to look down and see what gunk is on that ice, because that material probably came from, the solar system, but also those plumes on the bottom of Enceladus. What comes up must go down. And so we've looked at Enceladus, and I have a colleague who has modeled the deposition of that plume material onto Enceladus to see where it might build up. And if you could land there and find this deposit of, maybe it's like snow, maybe it's just like ice, who knows? But if you can show that that material came from the ocean, you've got a sample of an extraterrestrial ocean, that would be incredible.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about the work that it's going to take to sample the ocean on Europa, you're going to have to dig down through tens of kilometers of ice to actually reach the ocean. But with Enceladus, it's doing the hard work for us. It's throwing this material out into space. It's probably collecting in deposits right on the ice around the Tiger Stripes. And it's just a matter of, scooping it up and tasting it, which is, I believe geologists' main way to learn about rocks. And so it's just so convenient that right. We really have to go there. So I want to talk about sort of now maybe the role in phosphorus in terms of sort of biosignatures, as well as sort of our attempts to observe exoplanets. Right now we're at the very first stages. James Webb has been able to show the presence of carbon dioxide, water vapor, various large quantities of chemicals in the atmospheres of these other worlds. But what would if the resolution of its ability to detect the atmospheres could get that much better, what would you be hoping to see in the atmospheres of other exoplanets?
Yeah, that's a good question. Exoplanet biosignatures are a really fascinating topic of debate today. And we know so little about other planets. We know a lot about our planet, but there are so many different types of planets that we're finding out there. And new ideas are coming about at how you might produce these strange gases. So let's talk about some of these gases. Maybe our planet has a ton of oxygen, and that's a pretty rare compound to see. And the oxygen on our planet comes from photosynthesis. So if we were to go to another planet, and we use the James Webb telescope to look at this exoplanet, and we saw a ton of oxygen, does that tell us that life is there, that photosynthesis is happening? Scientists are working on it. It turns out that there might be ways to produce oxygen just using rocks. But I would personally be looking for sustained redox disequilibrium.
So I mean, and like one of the ones that I've sort of heard quite a bit is sort of these, you know, you talked about this with Enceladus, right? You've got this balance between the carbon dioxide and the methane at the same time, that that's an indicator. And so it's going to be these ratios potentially between methane and water vapor, methane and carbon dioxide. You think there's no one single chemical that'll get us there. It's going to have to be this sort of more holistic view of the atmosphere of the planet.
Yeah. In fact, that is where the biosignature field is going, I think, is there's this new idea about complexity. And if you look at not just one chemical, but the whole chemical system, and now you can look at the ratios between those compounds, as you said, and you start to get at complexity. If you just have sort of one molecule, just like water and salt, that's not super indicative of life. But if you have 10 million different organic compounds, we can use statistics and thermodynamics that can show that range of organic molecules wouldn't come about naturally. And so we're thinking about not just single compounds, but seeing multiple compounds in the same place. And so I think you said it well. The field is going a little bit towards this holistic route of trying to understand the system as a whole rather than honing in on a single chemical, because there are so many unknown geological processes that might produce those chemicals. You asked me earlier about Venus, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the purported detection of phosphine. Maybe you heard about this gas. So Nature reported that there was a detection of phosphine, which is PH3. It's a gas in Venus's atmosphere. And on Earth, we have a tiny bit of phosphine in our atmosphere, and it's thought to come from life. So it's thought to come from life doing some kind of metabolism and releasing this gas as a waste product. We find phosphine in places like muddy rice paddies, sewage, places with very little oxygen and lots of weird bugs. And so if you found phosphine in the Venusian atmosphere, does that mean it's life? Well, the problem is we've also discovered ways to produce phosphine abiotically. So even if you find phosphine on Venus's atmosphere, it doesn't necessarily mean that it came from life.
Yeah, and I always think of this as a great example of how difficult this search is going to be, that with that detection, we covered that a lot at Universe Today, that right away you saw a ton of papers both challenging the detection itself as well as challenging its role as a biosignature with having abiogenic, having abiotic ways that you could produce this chemical. And Venus is right over there, right? When you think about the distances involved to be making those observations of exoplanets that are tens of light years away, it just compounds the problem. And I think we as science fans, science fiction enjoyers, have to temper our expectations as the astronomers and the biologists do this very difficult work of teasing out this answer.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's incredible what we can already see in exoplanets. We're able to see the composition of atmospheres. I recently heard of a case where a star is eating a planet, and the material from the planet turns into plasma, releases light, and we can collect that light and actually use spectroscopy to see what elements were in that planet. So it's not just atmosphere anymore. In this one case where we see a sun eating its own planet, we can see what the planet is made out of. We can see silicon and magnesium and sodium. And so I think I'm a spectroscopist. So I use electromagnetic and other forms of spectra to understand the chemical makeup of my samples. So I look at rocks and I use X-rays and infrared and Raman to understand the chemical makeup. It's the same thing that James Webb is doing. It's a different range, a different electromagnetic range, and different interactions they're looking for. But it's a similar idea. As spectroscopy gets better, we're going to be able to better assess the chemistry of those atmospheres. And I do think we're going to get to a place where we understand life better so that we can make this paradigm of things to look for. It can't just be based on Earth life, because other forms of life might produce very different biosignatures. We have to work with what we've got. You know, we assume that CHNOPS, schnapps, are the elements that the life is going to need. But as spectroscopy gets better, maybe we'll be able to see these different compounds in different balances in those faraway atmospheres and start to say whether there's life there. I'm optimistic.
Yeah. I wonder, with spectroscopy, we understand the chemical fingerprints of these various chemicals because we can, you know, we have them here on Earth. We can see, you know, what they absorb, what they emit. But if there are chemicals potentially that are forming that we don't have in quantity or haven't even really examined, would we even recognize the absorption lines in the spectra?
Yeah, good question. I hadn't really thought about that. I think what you would see are these mysterious lines. You'd see the absorption pattern, and you'd really struggle to fit it to any compound you know. And if there were a compound that we don't have a good, you know, spectroscopic understanding of in abundance on an exoplanet atmosphere, life aside, that would be pretty cool. You know, yeah. like Titan has all of these organic molecules in its atmosphere. And I know that spectroscopists struggle to disentangle all of the information we get from that atmosphere because it's such a complex system.
Yeah, but it would be interesting if you see this, you know, the spectra of a planet, and you know, it's got clear lines, but the strongest one is one that we don't recognize.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, that would be really cool. We would probably want to do some theory to try and guess what kinds of compounds might make that absorption pattern. And then we might want to approach it the other way and think about what kinds of gases might build up on this planet, and maybe do some experiments to try and produce those compounds and then test the absorption pattern.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Harry Brodsky, and I hope you have a deeper understanding and appreciation for the role of phosphorus. Now, we went off tangent. Harry was part of a really interesting excursion to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and he got a chance to go down in the submarine Alvin to collect samples of basaltic material from the bottom of the ocean, kilometers below the surface. I had a chance to chat with Harry about his experience being in the submarine, what it was like to go down to the bottom of the ocean to collect samples in this really bizarre environment that human beings were just not meant to be in, and sort of how that affected him. Now, that longer conversation is available over on Patreon. It's available to any free member as well as paid member, so you don't have to give us any money to check out that interview, and we'll put a link down in the show notes so you can check that out. Harry, what are you obsessed with right now?
What am I obsessed with? I'm really obsessed with this mineral called awaruite. It's a metal alloy. So if I can talk a little bit about that, I'd love to.
Yeah.
So you probably know a little bit about iron meteorites that are falling all the time onto Earth.
There's one right there behind me.
Oh, really?
Me.
You got one?
Yeah.
It's
from the Campos del Cielo.
Nice. That's a great one. Yeah, that's a fantastic one. So these iron meteorites are always falling onto Earth. And As a phosphorus geochemist, they're really interesting because sometimes they actually contain that metal phosphorus that we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation. As I mentioned, most of Earth's phosphorus is actually metallic phosphorus in Earth's core. And most iron meteorites are thought to come from planetary cores that got blown up by collisions during the early solar system formation. And so when these iron meteorites come to Earth, they sometimes have this phosphorus as a metal. And that's really cool because that phosphorus metal is going to dissolve to form not phosphate, but reduced phosphorus compounds. So we're talking about a way to get reduced phosphorus into the ocean. All you need to do is bring in an iron meteorite with a little bit of metallic phosphorus. The problem is that it's not concentrated enough. It's not high enough mass flow. So it's great that we have these iron meteorites coming in to the Earth, but I don't personally think they're delivering enough of the reduced phosphorus fast enough to make a difference. So why are those iron meteorites so special? As I mentioned, it's this redox state. It's not oxidized at all. It has no oxygen. It's the exact opposite. It's metallic. It's super rich with electrons. And so when it dissolves, that reduced phosphorus can come out. That's great. But what people have neglected is that we actually have metal alloys forming on Earth in the crust. We're not talking about metal in the core. We're talking about metal alloys, iron nickel alloys, that form from very strange reactions that happen in these shallow mantle systems that are getting water from above. So the water comes down, percolates into the shallow mantle, turns into hydrogen. And then somehow it gets so much hydrogen that it turns iron minerals back into metal, if that makes sense. So to me, that's incredible because you basically have this battery. You have metal alloy in the crust. And if you touch phosphate to that metal, you're going to react the two. The phosphate is going to actually steal electrons from the metal alloy and become phosphite. So that metal alloy forms in rocks like this, in the mantle, or in the shallow mantle, rather.
I mean, as you said, you know, all of this phosphorus has been sequestered down at the core of the Earth, but there is this layer in the mantle where it's sort of keeping the process going.
Have you heard of the term serpentinization?
Only in preparing for our interview.
Gotcha. Yeah. So serpentinization is going to be a process that a lot of astrobiologists know about and think about. It's how mantle rock gets converted into a mineral called serpentine. But the important part is that it produces huge quantities of hydrogen. And as we mentioned, it's that hydrogen that can be the base of a chemosynthetic food web. So serpentinization is what powers those alkaline hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean with all the hydrogen. Now, we don't fully understand how it happens, but there are some interesting reactions during serpentinization that can actually produce these metal alloys. Awaruite, iron nickel alloy, is one of them. It forms in tiny, tiny quantities. Most of the time, it's nanoscopic. So we've got rocks with, like, you know, a couple 5-nanometer long awaruite crystals. And that's fantastic because it's metallic, it's reactive, it produces hydrogen, it produces organics. Now, in one place in the world, in the Josephine ophiolite in Oregon, you can find awaruite nuggets the size of your fist. And nobody is quite sure how that happened, because in a lot of other places in the world, you typically get tiny nanoscopic needles in your rocks that you have to find with really sensitive spectroscopic techniques on the nanoscale. But in Oregon, you can just find nuggets of this stuff, and we don't quite understand how you got so much of this metal alloy. But when I found out about that, I got really excited because I know that thermodynamically, you would predict that phosphate would react with that metal to produce phosphite, the reduced phosphorus compound. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, if you've got a lot of this metal alloy, then as phosphate from the ocean goes through and reacts with it, it'll come back out to the ocean as phosphite. And so I've been obsessed with this metal alloy called awarowite. And I've actually been doing some experiments with it too.
That's awesome. It's fascinating. And I think, you know, as we learn more about the universe and we learn more about life, you can really see that this sort of understanding the role that phosphorus plays is going to become ever more critical. So, Harry, thank you so much for taking the time to explain it to me, fulfilling one of my obsessions, partially anyway, and good luck with getting to the bottom of this question.
Thank you, Fraser.
Now, I'm just going to talk about some of my other thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew M. Gross, Barry Lake Roofing, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, Sean Sargent, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. When I talk to geologists like Barry and think about how difficult it is to actually follow the story of these chemicals like phosphorus and understand their role in the formation of life. And you can see how difficult it is just here on planet Earth, not to mention the controversies that we have in looking for phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus, about potentially being able to explore the chemicals coming out of the vents on Enceladus. It is a really complicated project and is going to require some of the best ideas for scientific experiments, for missions, for observations. And as we sort of extend that out to other worlds, when we look through observations from James Webb and future telescopes, we're going to spend this long period in this sort of murky, inconclusive time where we just don't have solid answers. We know that the scientists are making progress towards getting to the bottom of these questions, and yet nothing is going to feel really satisfying. And yet I think that is the process, that we have to be patient. We have to watch and go through these steps one by one to build up this case, both of the origins of life here on Earth, as well as the presence of life across the universe. And I'm sort of both impatient. I want to know the answer right now. And yet I am patient and I am enjoying the journey and the unfolding mystery. And I hope you are too. All right. We'll see you next time.